Governor DeSantis proposes the largest budget in Florida history. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The governor's budget is $91.3 billion. He plans on spending more on education and on Everglades restoration, and he wants to do it while cutting taxes. How realistic is that, and what sort of pushback might he get from the legislature? Also, during the civil rights era of the 1960s in Chicago, one man decided to use art as a peaceful protest. He called it AfriCobra, which stands for African Commune of Bad Relevant Artists. There's an exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami. We'll learn more about the history of the work. And
girls like me weren't supposed to be chefs. We didn't know that I could be a chef yet.
There's a new podcast from the Miami Herald hosted by James Beard Award-winning writer Carlos Frias. It's called La Ventanita. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. This weekend, a boat wrecked near the island of Abaco in the Bahamas. Authorities haven't confirmed, but it's believed that this could be a boat that was smuggling Haitians. Reports say 28 have died and 17 were rescued. We spoke with the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles to get an update. She joined us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral, and she started by giving us the latest information on the investigation.
The search and rescue is ongoing. As it stands at this moment, there are still 28 dead, 17 people who have been found alive. But Bahamian authorities are saying that they believe that there were as many as 87 individuals on board this boat.
Now, this is a boat, again, as we mentioned, it was in your story, a boat smuggling Haitian migrants. Is it typical for them to go to the Bahamas or in that direction, or were they coming to Florida?
Well, we do not know where they were headed. Where was the final destination? If it was Florida or the Bahamas or even the Turks and Caicos. I mean, what we do know is that often you do have boats that leave from Haiti with migrants on board. Often they do not know how many people are on board this boat. These are not really seaworthy vessels. They're wooden sailboats known as sloops, and oftentimes they're overcrowded, and they have been known to hit reefs, which authorities believe happened in this case. But they do not know the size of this boat or when it left Haiti, what time, how long they were out there, only that on Saturday, residents in the area of Abaco, which is in the northern Bahamas, reported finding four bodies floating in the water. And at that point, the Royal Bahamas Defense Force was contacted, divers went out, and a U.S. Coast Guard helicopter is the one that actually spotted the sunken vessel submerged at the bottom of the water.
Do we have any idea how many ships, vessels of any kind come out of Haiti trying to bring people out of Haiti?
We don't have any idea how many boats. What you do have often is a number in terms of migrants who get rounded up either in the Bahamas or the Turks and Caicos or turned around by U.S. Coast Guard. Those are the numbers that they keep. What we do know in the case of the Bahamas, they said that already for this year, I think it's somewhere over 300 migrants have been apprehended. But I can tell you that there has been several landings in the Turks and Caicos, which is 90 miles from Haiti. And in one of the landings, there was no boat that was found. They found migrants walking on the streets late at night with backpacks. So that is often what happens with these clandestine voyages, is that people arrive, they get dropped off, and or if they even get apprehended, the authorities don't often know who the smuggler is, because the smuggler assumes an identity of a migrant, and the people on board are told not to give up that migrant because either they still owe cash or the smuggler knows their family. So there's a fear factor. So there's a lot of, you know, in terms of ongoing investigation that's happening, I don't know how many answers the Bahamian authorities will get. But what often happens in these cases is that the migrants who do end up getting rescued, they are repatriated back to Haiti.
Do we know if the smugglers survived or if they're, if they have been captured by authorities?
We know absolutely nothing in terms of, and that's what we're trying to find out, whether or not, first of all, confirmation that it was a smuggling operation. I mean, all signs say it was, but the Bahamian authorities have not yet confirmed that. And then secondly, do they have the smuggler in hand? And I will tell you from our experience here in Florida, when these boats were coming into Florida, is that even our investigators often were not able to detect or determine who the smuggler was, because the smuggler would be among the people rescued and the people on board that boat would not give up the smuggler. So the smuggler just assumes the identity of one of the migrants, and so he gets deported back along with everybody else, and often they try again. I've been writing these stories, unfortunately, for too long. I've gone to the Bahamas. I've interviewed smugglers. I've interviewed people who've been on boats that have capsized, both in the Bahamas and in Haiti. And the story is the same over and over again, that when they land or they get caught, oftentimes the authorities can't tell who the smuggler is because the smuggler just assumes the identity of one of them.
What have the Haitian authorities said about this?
Well, you know, I spoke to Haiti's foreign minister yesterday, and he basically called it, heartbreaking. He tried to sort of put a lot of the responsibility on the part of the Haitian police in trying to deter these voyages. But one of the things that I noted to him is in some of these areas, these jumping off points, you don't even have 5 police officers in that area, much less, if they even have the vehicles to do it. And the Haitian Coast Guard, often their boats aren't even working and they have very few boats. So it's very difficult on that deter. I mean, the reality is that the economic situation in Haiti is deteriorating severely. The domestic currency is in a spiraling downfall. You have a situation today where we once again have a fuel shortage in the country. People are going days without electricity. Even individuals who are working are finding it difficult to afford basic commodities like rice and flour, which are imported. So as long as the economic situation remains bleak and looks like it continues to get even worse, people are going to take their chances and get on one of these boats, and try to search for a better life. And it's very unfortunate because you have no guarantee that you're going to make it alive.
Is there anything else about the story we need to know, or are we still basically just waiting?
I think right now that we're just waiting. I mean, the individuals have been, have been rescued. The authorities, the Bahamian authorities, are still searching the waters for people who may have survived, as well as for bodies. They still need to really confirm how many people were on board this boat, what was the size of this boat, and if, in fact, it sank because it hit a reef. At the same time, the individuals who have been rescued, they're going to be processed through the Bahamian system, and eventually they will be repatriated back to Haiti. But as part of, their past experience, there is a search ongoing, too, for the smuggler. And that individual will be held accountable in a Bahamian court if they are able to confirm his identity.
We've been talking with the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles, getting an update on the story of the 28 Haitians so far that we know died when a boat sank off the Bahamas. Jacqueline, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we have a link to the Miami Herald story on our Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Now, let's move over to state politics. The Florida legislative session starts a month from tomorrow, and lawmakers now have Governor Ron DeSantis' budget proposal to work with. The governor is proposing a $91.3 billion budget with increased spending in education and school safety, as well as Everglades restoration. He also wants to keep taxes low. Now, what did we learn about his budgetary priorities from his proposal that he released last week? Well, joining us now is Holly Bullard, Chief Strategy and Operations Officer for the Florida Policy Institute, and she joins us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. Holly Bullard, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So the initial proposed budget, $91.3 billion, largest in Florida history. Did the size of the number surprise you, given this is a Republican governor?
Well, we can't say that we weren't a touch surprised in our corner, and just really cautiously optimistic, as I think you see a lot of different advocates in the affordable housing, education, and a lot of these different areas are looking at this budget and trying to really read the tea leaves as to what the goals will be around the governor's budget and how he will actually create the policies with legislature to actually implement some of the budget.
What are the key ways that this differs from what we saw from the Rick Scott administration, especially in generating revenue?
Well, I think in terms of the revenue, the big response is rather than generating revenue is the difference in terms of tax cuts. And so something that we always have to think about with with DeSantis's budget is that this isn't just a snapshot in time. We are in 2019, comes off the heels of a decade of cuts for the state, for public services, and tax breaks continuing to compile in terms of Scott's focus on those tax breaks. So he averaged around $600 million tax breaks a year that added up to about $10 billion. And that is still, it's unseen in this budget. There's $91 billion for spending and a certain amount of new tax breaks that you see there in terms of the property tax small shift. But on top of that, we have what we call silent spending, so our tax expenditures. And within that are some of Scott's expenditures, some things that have been around since last century at about $20 billion for our state. We focus on tax breaks and different tax cuts for some very important for families, like when you go to the grocery store and things aren't taxable. That's really important for low to moderate income families not to spend that. But in terms of the revenue side, we see a bit of a departure from committing an entire the entire amount that we see increased revenue into the tax breaks. So rather than tax break, we see actually it being reinvested in some of the services that we think are really important for our state.
When you look at his budget proposal from a distance, I mean, what does it suggest about what Governor DeSantis's priorities are?
Well, for sure, you know, there's a quote that I love from Joe Biden. He said, "Don't tell me your values, show me your budget, and I'll show you your values." And I think that's what's going on here with this budget, from advocates and from all sides of the political spectrum, taking a cautiously optimistic stance. And from his bold vision is what he calls his budget, and we see the most bold steps around the environment, affordable housing. For the first time in over a decade, fully funding the Sadowski Trust Funds for affordable housing, which is incredibly important for places like South Florida. Transportation also, infrastructure, that could be a boost to the economy. You see highlights there. And maybe to a lesser extent, education. And he has a specific focus on workforce development. So those seem to be the outlined principles that he wants to really lift up with his budget.
And, of course, the session is coming up here in March. I mean, do we have a sense of where lawmakers stand on his budget and if he's going to get a lot of pushback?
Well, the only pushback I've heard are maybe some grumblings from the House in terms. But again, as any leader in politics, you want to be able to take the governor's budget and then also really forge your own way and to have your own policies and priorities set forth as well. So I think some of the pushback may also just be wanting to make a mark on their own. And so I think not too much pushback, to be honest, compared to the last decade. That's another complete departure from where we see Democrats being cautiously optimistic and wanting to work with some of the growth that we see in some of these areas between education, affordable housing. Maybe it's just in an effort to try to turn the page. And I think that's what he's trying to do with his budget as well.
We're talking with Holly Bullard. She's the Chief Strategy Officer for the Florida Policy Institute. We're talking about Governor Ron DeSantis's proposed budget for the 2019-2020 budget year, and he proposed this last week, and it's the largest budget for Florida. It's $91.3 billion. So looking at specific areas, let's look at education as an example. What can you tell us about his priorities for education, per pupil spending, and just the public school system in general? What does he want to do?
So very encouraging, or at least a step in the right direction in terms of the education per pupil spending. He proposes an increase to the highest level in nominal dollars, basically in real dollars that we see, versus the last few years that have had cuts and really, really struggle, lots of struggles at the local district level in terms of budgets because of cuts at the state level. So we see the highest level for pupil spending and for education, around a $200 increase per student. But important to note, only $50 of that is actually this broader flexible amount of spending that's called the base student allocation. So the other part of the $200 is actually for specific programming, and a lot of that has to do with the follow-up to the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas tragedy and the safety mechanisms put in place and mental health. So specific programs, but $50 is nothing really to scoff at compared to last year increase at that base student allocation of 47 cents. So just 200 times the amount of last year.
He's increased that. You talk about school safety. That's an interesting point too. What is his take on increasing school safety? Because after the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting, obviously the legislature passed the Marjory Stoneman Douglas Act, which looked at a number of different factors in improving safety on campuses. But where does Governor DeSantis want to take this now?
Well, some of that is still to be seen with his new education commissioner. But at the same time, we do see some we can read in the tea leaves in his budget, given that he continues some of the funds for the Guardian program, which is a program where volunteers and coaches, et cetera, it's actually called the Coach Aaron program, that he's rolling over dollars unused from last year into this year. So he keeps it there, and that's something that is more of a controversial program. But he actually increases dollars above and beyond what was input for last year for both construction of quote-unquote hardening schools, which is important not only for safety, but honestly, there's so much infrastructure issues right now with our schools. They're rated Ds in terms of our broader infrastructure from a national group says that our schools are in really need of actual upkeep. And so some of those dollars, as you see, hardening of schools and portables, things like that are really important, and the increase in mental health there.
Real quickly, we look at this $21 billion going to education compared to past governors. What's your take on DeSantis' plan for education compared, again, to the last three or four governors?
Well, there's still the devil's in the details, right? This is the broader kickoff, and I think we're all cautiously optimistic about policy, but the dollars are there for some interesting programs. Interesting is the increase in the bonus retention and recruitment program, formerly called the Bright and Best program, but then he's shifting it to something else. Basically to put his mark on it and to take away some policies for that the teachers hated. They really didn't like the fact that a bonus was tied to their SAT college entrance exams, which is always a little silly for many reasons. And so he took that away, but he hasn't yet filled out the rest of the details for the program. But he also basically wants to double that to $423 million for the state, which actually, if you were to just divvy that up across teachers in the state, they'd all get a $2,500 raise on its face, just pure divvying that up. And so that in itself, given that we are 42nd in teacher pay, that we still at this moment have 2,200 openings, and we have this huge teacher shortage in the state, and to really improve and to keep the momentum, you see a lot of momentum around outcomes for the state in terms of education, that teacher retainment, recruitment, especially in specific areas. It's a bit right in the details, but I think it's the investment there seems to be a good indicator for sure.
All right, let's move over to another big thing that was he was campaigning on, which is, of course, the Everglades restoration. He's asking for $625 million for the restoration, which would include the construction of a reservoir near Lake Okeechobee South in the farm fields. Is that enough money?
Well, that's a big question, right? It's about double than what we've had from last year. And that's the question broadly around a lot of our different budget areas, is that, you know, when you start from behind, coming up to this amount, that is, it's very difficult to say. But so it's yet to be seen. That there's $600 million for that, but there's broadly he proposes over his tenure about $2 billion investment in the environment in different ways. But definitely, perhaps for that one purpose, but there are some advocates who are cautiously optimistic, but do say that a lot of his investments are based on more of the cleaning up, right? So rather than a root cause of some of these issues.
You talk about cleaning up. Yeah, you talk about cleaning up, because he this was also very big in the campaign, was the issue of blue-green algae, the red tide. Is that money for the Everglades restoration, is that also to fight those issues, or has he got that separately?
Again, some of that is more of the implementation, and he has yet to roll out his implementation bill for this, where he talks about investing in some of these dollars, but you say, well, there's, especially in terms of prevention of some of these of the blooms and the issues that we see in the last couple of years, that there's policy on top of the funding. And that's, you know, yet to be seen. Those are a little bit of harder conversations with people about septic tanks, about policies and dumping and being a little bit more in the weeds in terms of the environmental protection. But he's on the front end, as again, I say that we are cautiously optimistic in his front on front end investment in these areas. So if there's actually a backup of policy to implement that, that's to be worked out over the next month and a half.
Now, one of the other things too about this budget is the fact that there's still a lot to pay out in Hurricane Michael recovery, mm-hmm. and just hurricane recovery in general. But what does the governor look at? What do you think legislators are going to be looking at when they consider everything that happened during Hurricane Michael, and do they have to readjust perhaps budgets, not knowing that we can get another Irma, another Michael at any point?
Right. For sure, he's diverting some of the funds that we have as predicted revenue increase in general revenue. There's about $1 billion more in our general revenue pot. That's the most flexible pot. And he's using some of that into Michael relief and hurricane relief. And mostly the increase that you hear and the investment that we're really sowing into that region in relief and repair is from the federal government. And so, but of note is that FEMA requires match. And so that's where you see the state putting up the dollars to receive the match. So it is important for the state to have that investment. But it's all contingent, to be honest, on this revenue prediction of $1 billion increase in terms of our general revenue. And that's contingent on the economy continuing to be pretty good over the next year. And so in about a month, we'll see another revenue prediction from the state in terms of what the sales tax could be bringing back. But if that holds, then I don't think you'll have to see a lot of push and pull in terms of taking away from another priority and putting it into Michael relief.
And that budget, again, the budget proposal from Governor Ron DeSantis, $91.3 billion, the largest in Florida history. But the session is coming up in March, so we'll see how it all plays out. We've been talking with Holly Bullard, a Chief Strategy Officer for the Florida Policy Institute. She joined us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. Holly Bullard, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much.
All right, still to come, we're going to check out a new exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Miami that looks at the black experience during the civil rights era of Chicago in the 60s. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A black arts collective founded 50 years ago in Chicago is the spotlight of an exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami. The exhibition entitled Africobra, Messages to the People, celebrates the work of the civil rights movement in the 1960s and 70s through the lens of black artists. The African Commune of Bad Relevant Artists was started by Jeff Donaldson with a focus of protesting through peaceful imagery. Now, the Museum of Contemporary Art has a series of events surrounding the exhibition as part of their Black History Month programming. Joining us now to discuss is Amanda Kovach, the new director of educational programming at the museum. Amanda, pleasure to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with this. How would you define Africobra? You know, when you think about the context of the civil rights movement of the 1960s, I mean, what was the role within the activist community? What were they trying to do with this?
So just not to lose context that there were a lot of other activists such as Spiral and a lot of other groups that were emanating out of that moment. The thing that defined Africobra as a collective was their manifesto and the cohesiveness of the nature of their work, such as all incorporating these colors called Kool-Aid colors, incorporating five core philosophical elements and having, you know, these kind of rules that they would work with and work towards. The images, was a commitment of humanism inspired by African people. Identification, they defined clearly their commitment as a people to the struggles of the African diaspora. Programmatic art, which dealt with the concepts that offered positive and feasible solutions. So they were aiming towards a goal. modes of expression, so they lent themselves to economical mass production, such as screen printing, and my favorite, which is expressive awesomeness, the goal towards the subliminal, the in-your-face kind of wow factor.
And a lot of the work going looking at it is very much in-your-face, because I want to talk about, especially with the Kool-Aid colors, because that is a fascinating concept. But real quickly, tell us about, briefly, about this lead artist, Jeff Donaldson, and his role in, you know, really in how he started this. What was he, again, what he wanted to do with this?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I've read and heard about Jeff Donaldson is he was a man who could walk in and change the atmosphere of a room. This group was founded in 1968, which of course was the same year as the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. It was when the United States was embroiled in the Vietnam War, and what he and the original founders were focused on was creating a positive images of the African-American community, such as their wall of respect, and creating, you know, this strength and exhibiting this just outward positivity to combat the negative light which the media was placing upon protesters, and which the media was placing upon the Black Panther movement and the race riots.
It was almost a continuation, it seems, when you think about it, like, as Dr. King's message was a peaceful one, much more peaceful one. This kind of seemed to go in that direction. Let's talk about some of the pieces. Let's start real quickly with, one of them is a fashion piece, and I couldn't stop looking at this. I've seen so many different photos now, and it pays tribute to the jazz artist of the time. Talk about the jazz scramble jacket. Mm-hmm. How do you describe that to people?
I mean, it's one of my favorite pieces by Jay Jarrell that we have in the show, and we're so lucky to have any of her pieces because she was a fashion designer. Her works are out in the world being lived in, which is really beautiful to have so many of her pieces in the show. And the way that I would describe the jazz scramble jacket is this, it feels like a Scrabble board, this kind of constructed through these linear pieces with this very supple leather like layering, and it's just really beautiful, and you can just get lost in finding all the names and finding all these people that have contributed to jazz history and perhaps aren't as well known or incredibly well known.
Oh no, it is. Again, just looking at photos, you can spend a lot of time reading the jacket, which is absolutely beautiful. Another piece that's striking in the exhibit, and this goes back to what you mentioned a second ago when you referred to the Kool-Aid colors. We talk about this incredible piece, and we heard from AfriCobra member Napoleon Jones Henderson explaining in a Chicago PBS documentary, Disabled to Obama, Chicago's Black Metropolis. Let's take a listen.
Well, the significance of the Kool-Aid colors had more to do with the color dynamics of the community, because if you can recall the 1960s, the pastel colors of clothing that men and women were wearing as they were strolling about the community were in those tones of colors that were lime and lemon and raspberry and strawberry, which were the flavors of Kool-Aid, and we all consumed a lot of Kool-Aid. So it just became something that was drawn out of the general community as an aspect of our looking at what we did in terms of the color palette of AfriCobra.
Amanda, how do you describe that? How do you take that and continue that? It is a fascinating piece. It's a fascinating idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way that we've continued it at MoCA is exemplified through the main AfriCobra title that we have, which I want to give a shout out to our graphic artist, Janelle Demby, who is also a continuation of the Howard Education. So when the artists saw her label and her logo, I mean, even Napoleon Jones Henderson has said that's rad. Like, that's AfriCobra. It's these bright, vibrant colors. And while every artist has their visual language, and it's very clear that each artist is an individual, the way the colors weave through and the way they just they pop and they shine is it's really what's so attractive about the work and what helps the work communicate as something fun, inspiring. And these kind of Kool-Aid colors, they're bright, they're vibrant, and they're positive.
Yeah, looking at some of the pieces, I mean, it was one of those things where The first thing that came to mind is like it almost seems to be moving because of the vibrancy and the way that those colors, as you said, they pop. It feels like the piece is moving no matter where you're how you're looking at it. I'm talking with Amanda Kovach. She's the educational curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Miami. There's an exhibition there called Africobra, Messages to the People, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Chicago Arts Collective. Now, there's a series of different public events happening around the exhibition for Black History Month, and we'll make sure to have those up on our Facebook or Twitter, again, at WLRN Sundial. It's important to note how much of the art collective's focus was on giving back to the communities they came from. This is a clip again from the Chicago PBS documentary, Chicago's Black Metropolis. First, you're going to hear from member Barbara Jones Hogue and then Napoleon Jones Henderson.
But the whole idea was in terms of creating art that would give positive messages to the people.
We are a vehicle for the community, and that the works that we've done, we've been privileged to do because those are the images and the aesthetics and ethos that we've derived from our community.
Now, you had the chance to talk to the curator, right? Jeffreen M. Hayes?
Yeah, Dr. Jeffreen Hayes, yes.
What do we know about, and I'm curious with those conversations, what did you learn about the artist collective's relationship with the community and why it was so important?
Well, you know, it was a real privilege to get to speak to her, and I'm looking forward to having her return for other conversations because I, you know, as a white passing queer Latina, was not coming from a point of knowledge or, you know, point of understanding, whereas Dr. Jeffreen Hayes really was able to tie everything into Miami, right? She was able to talk about, you know, the Freedom Wall, talk about these positive messages that they were sending out, talk about their screen printing and how they made images that they screen printed accessible at every one of their shows for $10. You could have a piece of Africobra work. And that went back to their modes of expression and how that tied back to what was happening here in Miami. So we get an example of Purvis Young's The Wall in Good Bread Alley. And she was the one who, in her curatorial talk that we had in December, made that connection. And I was just kind of like mind blown and how all of these things loop together.
You lead student groups through the exhibition from
yes,
time to time.
Yes, we do. All the time, yeah.
So I wonder what their take is on it.
I mean, you know, part of their take is they're very, I try to keep the tours as real as possible, you know.
What does that mean?
When I'm talking and tying it back into, for example, there's a piece that Dr. Jeffreen arranged along with our exhibition team called Speaking Truth to Visual, which is all about kind of readdressing the way the Black experience is portrayed in the media. And I start talking about thugification of young Black men. I start talking about misrepresentation of the Black lived experience in the media. And, you know, we talk about hashtag Black Lives Matter. We talk about, you know, just all these different things that we're currently experiencing. And it ties in so beautifully to the work that was being created at the time and is still currently being created because they are still a creative group.
I'm curious as to who's coming to see the exhibit. And by that, I'm straight up asking, is it, you know, do you see mostly the African-American community, the Black community coming in to see it? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, how many of the, say, the white community is coming in to see it? Who's seeing this?
Well, we're so lucky to be located in North Miami because we have an incredibly supportive community around us. And of course, they get in completely for free if you're a resident of North Miami. So I've seen a lot of residents stop by. I've held tours to large groups from people from visiting from France, visiting from all over the place. So I think that it's just a huge range, a spectrum of people, but definitely the people that have given me, you know, like the truest feedback have been people from the African diaspora and the African American community, because they're like, you know, this is good. This is what should be seen in museums.
And even after 50 years, it's still
so relevant.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Talking again with Amanda Kovach, educational curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Miami. Again, the exhibit, the Africobra, Messages to the People. And it runs until April or through April?
It runs until April.
Until April. So make sure you get the chance. Please check it out. Amanda, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Also, just want to mention real quickly, don't forget that tomorrow we're announcing our new title for the Sundial Book Club. Don't forget, you can join the book club on our Facebook group, Sundial Book Club. It's free to everybody. Let us know what you're reading. Still to come, a new podcast in Miami takes us to one of our favorite places, La Ventanita. That's coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, if you live in South Florida, then you already know what La Ventanita is, right? I mean, it's a staple of life, especially in Miami. And it's not just where you get your pastelito or croqueta or cafecito. Sometimes it's a quick grab and go, but for others, it's like hanging out at the bar in Cheers or the diner in Happy Days. It's where you hang out with your friends, your neighbors. You talk, you gossip, you socialize. Well, the Miami Herald's food editor, Carlos Frias, is using the Ventanita as the setting for his new podcast by the same name. La Ventanita gives listeners an inside look in the life of some of the world's top chefs from South Florida, beginning with a box full of warm Cuban pastelitos and fresh Cuban coffee, or of course what we know as coladas. Frias and the chefs discuss topics like immigration, women in the culinary field, family, food innovation, childhood, and of course food and coffee. Carlos joins us now in studio. Carlos, great to have you back, man.
Yeah, it's great to be here, man.
Congratulations. You got your own podcast now. You're going into the podcast world.
I'm giving you a wide berth. I'm not going to be infringing on your professional territory.
We
just wanted to try something a little different for the Herald and try to expand our reach to folks who just like to listen.
Where did the idea come from? When did that conversation begin? You said, hey, this could be a great podcast idea.
Well, it kind of happened by accident. This time last year, they offered me an interview with the chef who had the number one restaurant in the world, and it was not somebody anybody had ever heard of, or a few people, unless you're inside the food world.
Wait, he's the number one chef in the world?
Yes.
Is that what you said? But nobody's ever heard of him.
Massimo Bottura. You know that name?
No, I don't.
Oh, there you go. Proves my point.
Okay, thank you for that. Embarrassing me. That's all right.
No, I'm because most, but I knew that. So I said, I'm only interested in that interview if I can, I don't know, bring him a box of pastelitos or something.
Right.
And they all kind of raised their eyebrows and were like, we'd be okay with that. So I brought him this box, and it just, each thing sparked a new conversation and a turn of phrase and a memory about childhood and about flavor and culture. And then we thought, why don't we do this on purpose? And we plotted out. We thought of six chefs who had both a national presence but also had a foot in Miami.
Yeah,
they each have a restaurant here. And thought, let's bring them a box of pastelitos and see what happens. And so what happens turned out to be pretty interesting.
Because you do the podcast. Is it at one place or you're going to different ventanitas?
Well, we try to take, we go to a different ventanita and then we take it, with the way we did it the first time is we took it to their restaurant in Miami. So we kind of took over the restaurant for a little while, but we brought them a place that was very Miami. Each of the pastelitos came from a different place, and they were both very Miami places that were run by families for, you know, decades, you know, if not generations of families.
How did you, coming back to how you decided to pick the certain people, because there are a lot of people you could have chosen, but again, it's six episodes for the first season. So how did you come down to that final list?
Well, we just swung for the fences. We thought, you know, which of these chefs, again, both have a national presence and have a presence in Miami, but are people that if you're in the food world, you would instantly recognize. And if you're out of the food world, you might recognize.
Norman Van Aken, you hear him here on air, Chef Jose Andres, Michelle Bernstein, Marcus Samuelson. Yeah, pretty impressive list.
Yeah, Thomas Keller and Daniel Boulud. You know, Daniel is probably one of the greatest living French chefs. Thomas Keller, he redefined really American fine dining. He really put it on the map. So it was all these folks that, you know, both were, you know, maybe TV chefs, maybe not necessarily TV chefs.
All right, let's start. One of the episodes you talked to Chef Andres, his nonprofit organization, World Central Kitchen, cooked more than 3.5 million meals for people in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. And he recently did the same for furloughed workers during the federal government shutdown. Let's hear a clip from your conversation with him.
You know, it's very hard sometimes to understand that behind something like this is the name and the last name of men and women that work long hours to make these things happen, to maintain the traditions, in the process, being able to provide to their family members. I do believe that we need to think sometimes with a sense of trying to understand what's behind every one of the foods we eat. Mm-hmm.
What was the most fascinating part of your conversation with him?
Jose Andres, it's funny because we started, he was like, I can't believe you brought food to a restaurant to a chef. And then at first he like caught me a little bit back, but I said, oh, because you're too fine and fancy to eat this food, this low food. And then it just, I think it disarmed him. And from then he was always looking for an opportunity to like poke fun and laugh and stuff like that. And when you see somebody on TV like that, you know, you wonder, you know, how are they, you know, man to man, to a person. And he was just really engaging and really funny and had great insight into almost anything I asked him.
One of the things I think is interesting about the podcast, and it's what I love about podcasting, is that there are no rules, mm-hmm. right? I mean, in radio, we have specific rules on how we have to do a show, but in podcasting, you try anything. So, I mean, your conversations, you know, you'll sit down with somebody and you start talking and the conversation can start anywhere and it could lead in any direction. And then all of a sudden, food shows up. Coffee shows up, and now you switch the conversation over to that for a little bit and then come back to the original conversation. How much of it is pre-planned and how much of it is sit down, turn on the mics, let's see where this goes?
Well, definitely it was all just kind of flying by the seat of our pants. You know, in other words, I had done my research on each of the chefs and I knew some of the things I wanted to talk about. So I carried like a mental list of five things that like I wanted to ask them. And then I kept the food in front of us. So like if there was a lull in the conversation or it looked like things weren't going anywhere, I'd say, hey, why don't we try a pastelito de guayaba? And you would bite it, and you know, and I promise folks, I cut out all the munching on audio. So
yeah, you don't hear any of that.
There's no munching. So like folks I know get triggered on that, but this is your trigger warning. There's none of that. So we would, you know, and I'd say, this is something that reminded me of my childhood. What's something that you ate that reminded me you of your childhood? And then it was a nice little buffer in case the conversation stalled.
No, because it does sound like it's a natural conversation. I'm sure that like any podcasting, there's editing afterward. As you said, you're taking out sound that's not necessary, but it sounded like you just sat down with any of the guests and just started talking.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, I edited it myself, but the person who actually mixed it, who did the mix and the cutting and everything else, was this guy named Julio Alvarez, who's my cousin, and he was one of the audio producers on folks on Moonlight. So the guy is like got this great talent. And he basically just said it, I asked as a personal favor, will you help me do this? And he was like, yeah, come on over.
if anything, always just bring your family into it, of course.
And bring food.
And food. Talking with Carlos Frias, he is the creator and host of the new Miami Herald podcast called La Ventanita, or The Little Window. It's a podcast about his conversations with some of the top chefs here in South Florida. You can find it on iTunes, so definitely check it out. Again, 6 episodes in the first season. You talked with Michelle Bernstein, and she talked about life as a female chef, especially what it was like before the Me Too movement. This is interesting because we had a conversation not too long ago with some female chefs about what it's like. And not a lot of women get to that position. But this is a fascinating conversation. Let's hear a little clip.
Girls like me weren't supposed to be chefs. We didn't know that I could be a chef yet. Mm. It still was this big bubble, a very pretty bubble of, you know, being put in front of a television or whatever it might have been, but it was definitely still not in the role of a chef. Because we didn't know that girls like me could be chefs. Right. It wasn't even the realm of possibilities yet.
I mean, this conversation, like a lot of them, have its fun moments, but this gets into some really intense stuff. What did you take most away from that conversation?
You know, when we wrote the stories, I tried to boil down some of the most interesting things and write like a Reader's Digest version. And that's really what I focused on because she was so honest and so forthright about almost like this is a thing we haven't been able to talk about for 20 years, you know, since the 20 years she's been in a kitchen because, you know, you're sometimes, in her case, she was sometimes the only woman in the kitchen with these really great chefs. Yeah. So she was really like, you know, we joke about it now, like we're talking about, you know, during the interview. She's like, but there were times that got really, you know, that bordered into and went into harassment. You know, one of the things she said, she's like, I can't even tell you what would happen when I would bend over to tie my shoes. And I didn't ask because you know what? We almost don't need to.
Yeah, people can learn a lot from that conversation. What do you think would be the biggest takeaway for them?
I think that that a lot of the things that we just kind of take for granted that we men in general might have been brought up a certain way to kind of not even think about it forces you to think about those interactions, and I think that that's a good thing, you know, to not feel like you're walking around with this privilege that you get to kind of stomp on all the territory that you want without thinking about who gets hurt along the way. And I think that someone like Michelle Bernstein is an example of someone who came through that and then basically said, I'm going to do this my way now that I have a name. And I think she does a great job at lifting up other chefs, whether they're men or women. There's a couple that owe their careers to Michelle Bernstein.
What have you heard from listeners? What have you heard from the audience about the podcast?
You know, so far it's been pretty positive. I got to say, I've been really pleasantly surprised that folks have listened at all. I mean, folks, if you've listened and you've left a review on Apple Podcasts, I am eternally grateful. Whoever Charlie C is and left a really nice review, thank you, brother.
Have you heard from chefs who've been listening?
Yeah, some of the chefs have been nice enough to retweet the stories. And hey, chefs, if you guys are listening and want to send those out to your loyal listeners, I'd be grateful.
So, I mean, what would you say you've learned from this experience, your first, I guess, entrance into the podcast world? But, and really, if anything, is there going to be a season two?
The thing that I've learned the most is to check my gain stages when I record audio.
You're going to get technical.
Yes,
now.
I'm right. Getting super technical. I've learned a lot about audio from people who know way more than I do. And if there's whether there's a season two, all depends on whether there's enough interest in this season. Folks want more.
But what do you think it's going to take? I mean, like, how would that decision be made to say, all right, we're ready for a season two? Because you've got to have a list of other people you'd want to talk to.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think, you know, to be 100% perfectly honest, sponsorships. Honestly, it would take money from someone to say, hey, we'd like our name associated with this thing, you know, after the fact, you know, to say, hey, this is something that, you know, that we also believe in. And, you know, we want to put some money behind it because that's really what it comes down to, man.
You know, I mean, there are podcasting companies and look, anybody can put a podcast together, but that doesn't mean you can. NPR, public radio, understood that, you know, podcasting was a way to go. And so there's just been a lot of public radio podcast produced. But I've noticed newspapers now over the last couple of years getting deep into podcasting. Is this kind of where the industry is going? What, I mean, is it something that you're going into or just something to add to the work you're already doing?
I think it's, if you don't do this, you get left behind. It's not, some folks will say, oh, this is groundbreaking things. And it's like, no, either you do this, either you experiment with storytelling in every medium that you have available to you, or you become irrelevant. And I personally want to have a long career in journalism. And it doesn't matter to me whether I write or whether I have conversations like this one on camera or in audio. You know, I want to keep telling good, great, interesting stories, and it doesn't matter how you do it.
Yeah, but as a storyteller, do you prefer one or the other? Do you like, I mean, you're a writer by nature, but, you know, now that you've done some podcasting, I don't know, what do you enjoy?
I could get spoiled by it. It's kind of interesting. It's pretty fun. I still enjoy all of it. But I could be talked into a season two if there's interest.
All right. So real quick, La Ventanita, again, it's on iTunes. If you had that 15-second pitch, how do you convince people this is something they should check out? They should put this on their iTunes list.
Look, I brought six of the world's greatest chefs a box of pastelitos, and it sparked great, distinctive, totally different conversations with each one of them. And if you'd want to hear it, it's at miamiherald.com/Ventanita. That's VENTANITA. Ventanita.
You know what? It's just like being on Shark Tank. There you go. We're sold. We're on it. Carlos Frias again, creator and host of the new Miami Herald podcast, La Ventanita. Six episodes. Again, great conversations with some of the top chefs here in South Florida. And they do it while they're eating and drinking cafecitos and croquetas, and it is absolutely charming. It's a wonderful podcast. Carlos, absolutely, man. Congratulations.
Thank you, man.
All right.
Thanks for having me.
Next time, you and I, we should just go ahead and do a podcast together.
I'm in. I'm sold.
We'll tag team it together. So, All right. We'll have more on our Facebook page, by the way, so you can check it out as well. Well, that's our program for this Monday, February 4th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.